welcome to another episode of The Middlers. Today we have an exciting and insightful topic, which is a much misunderstood topic, which is the political and social situation in Pakistan. Pakistan is very much an enigma in the Western part of the world. People know sound bites from television and some articles when it appears on Time magazine and some of the major publications. But really, what Bill and I wanted to do today is have a little more in-depth discussions about the intricacies of the politics in that country right now. And to that end, Bill, I'm really excited to have this conversation with our special guest, Sharaf Uddin, today. How do you feel about this, Bill?
Yeah, I feel great. I think this will be an interesting topic. With Sharaf Uddin here and with you, Yusuf, I think the depth of context that you guys have is going to mean that I'm going to occasionally contribute as someone who's looking at Pakistan from quite a distance and through the American lens. I will say that during my time in India, I was on the ground in India when Benazir Bhutto was assassinated, and I was also in India when Nawaz Sharif tried to land a plane in Pakistan, and basically the country was shut down, tightened up, and he was not allowed off the plane. So I have vivid memories, but candidly, they're glimpses of a country that I do find consistent mystery in my understanding of South Asia.
Yeah, so hopefully we can add to that today. And with that, I'd like to welcome our guest, Sharaf Uddin, who is, when I was looking around for people who understood the Pakistani context and South Asia for that matter, he is somebody I came to mind, who I know personally and socially. So Sharaf Uddin, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you very much. Good evening. I would like to particularly thank Bill and Yusuf for inviting me to your chat room this weekend. It's an honor and privilege for me to be speaking to you about a country I know a little bit more about other countries. And by way of introduction, my name is Syed Sharaf Uddin. I have been associated with the politics and foreign policy of Pakistan for a number of years, having been a Pakistani diplomat before I took retirement, and in the Commonwealth Secretariat in London, where I worked for about 10 years, I closely studied the countries in the Asian region, and of course, Pakistan went through a difficult period because there was a overthrow of a democratically elected government, and the Commonwealth has a rule. They suspend countries which are not governed democratically, and therefore my involvement with that country was quite close. So with that background, I think I'll be able to answer your questions, and if I disappoint you, obviously, you're free to choose any other Pakistani expert.
No, we specifically chose you because I value your opinions on this and your expertise. So, Sharaf, let's start the conversation with whether the third time is going to be a charm for Nawaz Sharif. He's back in power. What does this mean this time around based on the landscape of Pakistan today?
Yeah, before I take that question, let me just make one point, and that is I was recently in Washington, and I met a few people, including Pakistani expatriates who are now U.S. citizens, but they very much would like to know about Pakistan. And one general comment I got from those people was that Pakistan is not discussed at the Capitol Hill at public debates as much as U.S. is discussed in Pakistan. And obviously the response of our American friends was that why should Pakistan be so special? There are many other countries that are going through problems and challenges, and it is quite presumptuous of Pakistanis to expect that there would be a great deal of debate about Pakistan in the United States. And I guess, Bill, with your experience in India, probably it's the same thing, that New Delhi has got so many other countries to discuss and worry about rather than just discuss Pakistan. But what happens in Islamabad is the discussion somehow or the other gets back to Pakistan-U.S. relations, Pakistan-India relations, and that defines very much the Pakistani mindset in terms of their foreign policy. So having said that, I think I'll take your question in the same context. Coming back of Nawaz Sharif as for the third time as the Prime Minister, there are both challenges and opportunities for the Prime Minister. The context has definitely changed from his previous terms. When he was Prime Minister previously, the security issues were not as serious as they are now facing Pakistan. Of course, Pakistan seems to have inherited a security situation around its borders because of the geostrategic location of the country that it can't escape them. But this time, the situation is very serious in the sense that these security issues emanate from within Pakistan, and the military, in its redefined strategy, has already declared that the biggest threat to Pakistan comes from within rather than from outside. So he has this big security challenge that how to fight terrorism within the country and how to take all the different shades of Armenian along with him in such a way that he continues to retain popularity and majority in order for his party and himself to complete the term, because there is always a threat of a vote of no confidence if he falters on the policy that he adopts.
So a quick question on that. So the threat from within has been a mainstay since, let's say, the Musharraf times. 9/11 happened, and the threat from within, the terrorism threat, the Taliban, etc. But one nuance to Nawaz Sharif and the expectation of him is some sort of economic upheaval, him being from the business community. Is that a realistic expectation of him this time around? Because even with all what was going on with the internal issues, Musharraf was able to bring around somewhat of an economic, not a turnaround, but economic improvement with the unprecedented amount of foreign reserves and the economy and upswing. And from the United States, there was a considerable amount of movement back to Pakistan for Pakistani Americans. So is this economic expectation realistic of Nawaz Sharif?
Yeah, actually, he has got two types of major challenges. One is the security challenge, and of course, it has been there for quite some time, but the only difference is that he was not in power, and therefore, people are looking at him to see what he can do as the elected prime minister of the country, although, as you say very rightly, the security paradigm has existed quite some time ago when General Musharraf decided to join the alliance of countries who decided to do a joint military action against the terrorists in Afghanistan. He has got the second big challenge, and that is economy. During Musharraf's time, the economy was not that bad. And of course, in the last 5 years of Pakistan People's Party's government, the economy did not make significant improvement, which was expected of an elected government. For instance, when he succeeded the previous prime minister after the elections, he realized that the power shortages, which are fundamental to the industrialization of Pakistan for the economic development and exports, have continued to hurt the industry, let alone the domestic requirements of Pakistan. And therefore, lack of industrial progress, not being able to address the issues of unemployment, a huge rising international debt that Pakistan has to service every year. These are some of the major challenges that come together with security. And in a sense, security and economy go together. If the security situation improves, chances are that economy will automatically improve. There will be more investment. There will be more confidence. At least the Pakistanis themselves will start reinvesting before you can look at foreign investors. Having said that, he has one advantage, which he can use very to his advantage, and that is the political advantage of not having a military threat to the elected government. I think the appetite for military coups is now gone down in Pakistan, and it was tested during the last 5 years of the Pakistan People's Party government. People were expecting that the military might step in, interfere, or try to dictate. It didn't. And therefore, now Nawaz Sharif can take it more or less guaranteed that it wouldn't be the kind of threat that he has to worry about. Secondly, there seems to be an entente cordiale, some sort of a written understanding between the political parties that they will not try to pull each other's legs, they will not try to undermine each other. So the level of government-opposition relations that we see today in Pakistan is quite encouraging because that's what you expect in a democracy where the opposition understands its role. It supports the government where there is a national interest. It criticizes the government when it thinks that the government is not performing. So we have seen now, after Nawaz Sharif's election as prime minister, that he has not taken a vendetta against Pakistan People's Party. He has sent off the new, the former president, Zardari, in a very nice way, as is expected in a democratic setting. So the relationship between political parties is emerging as it should be in a mature democracy, although there is a long way to go.
At the expense of sounding too optimistic, because I know Pakistanis are very generally very cautiously optimistic when they speak about Pakistan, this does sound like some sort of maturity on the continuum, lack of threat or diminishment of threat from the military that they will take over, and also some sort of understanding between the political parties. Is this a democratic maturity that we're seeing?
I think it's a forced democratic maturity because taking over the reins of power is no longer as attractive as it used to be before. The military knows quite well that if they try to interfere in the political situation today, they will end up trying to sort of face the same mess and difficulties and challenges that the elected government of the past, Pakistan People's Party, and now the Nawaz Sharif party are facing. So it's a kind of a forced maturity which hasn't come just because they have decided that they would walk the democratic path, but it is because of the circumstances that they are moving in that path where they're leaving the political parties to resolve the major challenges through negotiations, patience. And what helps the present government is the experience of the prime minister coming for the third time, and he's very cautious. People are criticizing him for not doing much in the first 100 years of his government, 100 days of his government. And you can see why he has decided not to take hasty steps. He understands that unless he examines the issues properly, takes the people along with him, any hasty steps can be a disaster, as we have seen in Egypt. If you try to turn around the economy and bring in policies which are not discussed through a national debate, which are not debated in the parliament, then you take a chance and a risk. Either you become so successful that you become a hero forever, or your term is cut short because you prove that you have taken hasty steps and you do not have the democratic patience that is required to do the debate and develop a consensus, which takes time. So these are signs which show that he is going slow. He's not unaware of the issues. And of course, when we talk about him, we're not just talking about one person, one leader. We're talking about the parliament, about the cabinet, and the political parties that are all part of the process.
You know, talking to you, I can clearly see the difference between talking about Pakistan and its politics and its issues in dinner time conversation and talking to somebody who has deep insight into political science and history. So thank you so much. I'm really enjoying the conversation. Bill, you wanted to chime in and add something.
Yeah, I have a question. Not that the American system is without flaw, but when I listen to what's being said about the role of the military and that it's a sign of optimism that a military takeover is less likely, I was thinking through, so in the American system, the people elect their representatives. The representatives have the Congress, there's the executive branch, and then the Supreme Court, the three different parts of the U.S. government. And the military is under the guidance of the government, and even the president refers to himself as the commander-in-chief. But if you follow the sequence of the people representing, I'm sorry, the people electing representatives and the representatives overseeing the military and the military answering to it, you could reasonably say the American system is one in which the military is run by the people. Is there a recipe in Pakistan's future where the military may conceive of itself as being under the guidance of the government and thereby the people? Because it sounds like that's very much not the case historically or even currently.
Bill, that's a very fundamental question that you have asked, and I think it's a question that not only applies to Pakistan, but actually it applies to some Islamic countries where democracy is trying to take roots. I can even mention Turkey, Egypt, where the military has been traditionally very strong. In the context of Pakistan, let's just draw a very clear distinction between the American political system and the Pakistan political system. The American political system is clear. It doesn't have any confusion, and everybody knows that it's a presidential system. It's based on popular support. And of course, you mentioned the executive, which is known as the administration in the U.S., the Congress, and the Supreme Court. What Pakistan has is a Westminster model of democracy, where the head of government is not the president, but the head of government is prime minister. And he collectively leads a team of the cabinet, and therefore he is not individually responsible for his actions, but he is member of a collective college, which is called the cabinet, and then he is the senior minister in that cabinet, and therefore the prime minister. However, the relationship between the executive, the parliament, and the judiciary in a Westminster style of democracy is more or less the same as it is in the United States. And of course, the military is subservient to the parliament, to the legislature, because the head of the military is a civil servant who gets paid from the exchequer, from the treasury, and is not an elected representative. He performs his functions and is elected on the basis of his seniority and his professional competence. So those fundamental elements of a democratic system, whether it is in a presidential form of government or a parliamentary form of government, are common. What has happened in Pakistan is that there has been an experiment as to where the power actually lies in the executive. And there has been quite a bit of confusion as to whether it is the prime minister who is all-powerful or whether it is president who is all-powerful. Although the constitution says that the prime minister is the head of government and the president is head of state, there has been a great deal of confusion as to where really the power lies. And if you look at back at some of the, let's say, last 10, 15 years of Pakistani politics, you can see this confusion being, instead of getting resolved, it becomes even more compounded. The last president, President Asif Zardari, was the head of the party, which was the ruling party, and he was the president. And everybody knew that it was the president who was calling the shots, not the prime minister. In fact, the prime ministers were simply the rubber stamps, and whatever the president wanted, it was being sort of agreed to by the prime ministers. And some of the prime ministers that we see under Zardari were very clearly, everybody knew that they were the most incompetent and not really the true leaders that one expects the prime minister to be. And then on the other extremes, we have seen that sometimes the prime ministers have been very powerful, which is now. The Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has brought a person who is a unknown commodity in the politics of Pakistan. He comes from a minority province. He is a member of the party. So what you see in the UK, for instance, where the Westminster democracy is actually very strong and is a model democracy for many Commonwealth countries and others, is that the head of state is someone who enjoys the confidence, the respect, and the consensus of the entire state, that the queen, that is, that she is really somebody to look at as the head of state. And then you have the prime minister who's completely independent and performs his role as the head of the cabinet. In Pakistan, this confusion remains. And therefore, coming back to your question, unless they really define where is the center of power in the Pakistani constitution, which is with the prime minister, the military will not be able to understand very clearly to which part of the executive they should hold their allegiance to. They have been playing around between presidents and the prime minister in the past, and that has been one reason why the Pakistani military leaders of the past thought that they had the support of one side of the executive, either the presidency or the prime ministers, that led them to overthrow the democratically elected governments. Again, coming back to the present time, I think if the president is a known commodity, if the president does not seem to have too much power, which is a good sign because this is what the Pakistani constitution demands of a president, and it gives all powers to the parliament and the prime minister and places the military chief under the parliament and under the executive branch of government.
So, a question for you. I don't know the exact year, but I'm relatively certain that it was after 9/11 and that it was during a time George W. Bush was the U.S. president. And I remember a press conference at which President Musharraf was visiting the U.S. And he said something that stuck with me, and I'm not sure I have the exact words, but relatively close to these words, he said that his vision for Pakistan was an open, progressive, forward-thinking, modern Islamic republic. And I remember hearing that and wondering if there is a model that could be looked at for such a country. And, of course, to me, I think Turkey appears to be probably the most meaningful model out there today. And that's a country I have visited in the last year. And I think there is some truth to that. But the question that I have for you is religious allegiance a fundamental part of a future Pakistan such that it must be part of the description of its future?
That's a very interesting question. And I think Musharraf has not only said this in New York, but also in many of his speeches, that his vision was one of a progressive, modern, and forward-looking Islamic nation. And again, he also made no secret that he looked at the Turkish model as a model that he could probably adopt for Pakistan. His problem was, or let's say his difficulty was, that he was not a democratically elected leader to be excuse me, in a position to get his ideas implemented without using the authority of the military, and obviously when he left everything else with him that he tried to introduce disappeared. The fact remains that there are only two countries in the world which gained independence or which got a piece of territory in the name of religion or in the name of sort of safeguarding their religious ethos are Pakistan and the State of Israel. In the case of Pakistan, there has been a great deal of debate that the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, wanted he had the same vision as that of Musharraf, or perhaps Musharraf borrowed his vision of a modern, without using the word secular, modern, forward-looking Islamic state. It is therefore very difficult to remove any religious connotation from the Pakistani mindset to say that religion belongs to homes, it's a private affair, and therefore what you need to do is look ahead only in secular terms. And there will be a lot of opposition amongst the masses, not perhaps amongst the intellectuals, the urban classes, but amongst the masses who still would very much want to associate their country, their social and cultural values with Islamic values. And what they're trying to do now is to see if they can create a society which does not divorce itself from a statement of an Islamic society, but at the same time be a modern and forward-looking state. And there have been many steps which have been taken in the direction. Some of the steps that sort of have been introduced in the past have not been undone because of the same reasons. For instance, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who himself indulged in social drinking, was the one who introduced prohibition in Pakistan. And that more or less legally continues to the day, although everybody knows that in Pakistan, prohibition does not stick to the letter and spirit of the law. He was also the one who declared a minority sect. It was during his term, actually, the minority sect of Ahmadis as non-Muslims. Again, to this date, legally, it has not been undone, repealed. And this shows that it is very difficult for Pakistani lawmakers to try and enact laws which show that they are now relegating religion or religious connotation to the margin and moving away with a narrative which is very much modern and secular. So the difficulty of Pakistan would be that it will have to carry along the Islamic subtext along with the rest of the legal system. But the recent war against terror, I think, has shown everyone in the country that extremism, fundamentalism, and irrationalism, which is more or less equated with fascism, is not the future of Pakistan. And therefore, the mindset is slowly and gradually changing, and especially the mindset of the youth, who are now beneficiaries of this opening up of globalization, are beginning to see that they need to take a different direction for the country if they are the ones who are going to be the leaders and are the beneficiaries of this country.
Thank you.
So any conversation about Pakistan seems incomplete until we bring India into the mix. What does Nawaz Sharif's third time in power mean for the relationship with India? I know one of the bases of the altercation between Musharraf and Nawaz Sharif was India and Kargil and the future of the relationship with India. So anything different on the horizon for the relationship with India?
I think India-Pakistan relations has been the main feature of the two countries' regional policies. Of course, both countries look globally as well across the seas. But within the South Asian region, India-Pakistan relationship occupies such a central stage that without any improvement in these relations, any kind of a regional grouping, whether it is economic, political, social, or even consular or free movement of people without restriction of visas is unthinkable. The advantage that the Prime Minister has in this government is that he has a track record of being consistent on the claim that he would like to see India and Pakistan normalize their relations to the extent that there is increased confidence in each other, there is exchange of trade cultural delegations, and close relationship between the peoples of the two countries. As you mentioned that in his previous government, he was trying to negotiate that kind of a relationship when Kargil happened. And of course, the Indians also know that in those days, the military mindset was quite different from the thinking of the elected government. So the prospects seem to be very good in the present government. I think they've already started talking to each other at the senior officials levels. And once the confidence-building measures are more or less increased, there will be opportunities for greater cooperation. We should not forget that also in the last few months, there has been an increased firing along the line of control in Kashmir. The Indian troops have fired on Pakistani troops, and vice versa, the Pakistani troops have fired on the Indian side, and in fact it has resulted in casualties of the Indian military. These distractions will continue because it's a big country, India is a big country, and there will always be attempts from the vested interest groups who would not want to see normalization taking place. So the leaderships of the two countries, especially the Pakistani leadership, will have to be patient. They will have to be resolute and not detract themselves, not allow to be detracted themselves from the main focus, and that is to work towards the normalization and improvement of relations with the neighbors, starting with India, and then not be taken away by the detractors, who will do their best to take them away from this direction.
It's Bill. I have a question. So as an American, you consistently pick up the message about who our friends are, and always have heard that Pakistan is a U.S. ally and India is a U.S. ally. And during my time in India, I found that was, while a true and repeated refrain from the U.S., it was a bit of a complicating factor to have allies that have such historical enmity with each other. So what does it mean to say that Pakistan is an ally of the U.S. while at the same time in the Northwest frontier province we are consistently pursuing Islamist insurgents as well as putting drone attacks forth in a way that is pretty consistent and deeply unpopular in the land where we call Pakistan our ally?
Yes, it's a very complicated relationship, and I think some of this relationship has got its roots in history. And because of the relationship or the lack of it between India and Pakistan, somehow or the other, Pakistan's relations with United States and United States relations with India were seen in Islamabad as being mutually exclusive. So that is to say, it's the same George Bush statement that if you are not with us, then that means you are against us. And that's how Pakistan also interpreted that if you are not, if you are too friendly with India, that means you are against us. And that mutual exclusivity, which was assumed by Pakistan unilaterally on its side in regards to its relationship with the United States, created those problems where when you had a visit by a U.S. President or a senior congressional delegation to New Delhi, Pakistan expected that the same delegation should come to Islamabad as well and spend equally the same time, the same number of days, because there was an equation in the subcontinent between India-Pakistan relations. Those expectations were misplaced because countries determine their relationship with other countries purely on their bilateral interests, whether these are economical, these are driven by military sales, or trying to extend your influence in a region where you probably might feel that it is waning. And I think now in Islamabad, there is this realization that you cannot just compete with the United States with everything that happens between the United States and India. So that's one realization, and it's a good realization because Pakistanis should develop the relationship with the United States irrespective of their relationship with any other country in the region or elsewhere. As far as drone attacks are concerned, the present government has taken a position. It's a declared public position. And if you will remember, the second day on the third day of the inauguration of the cabinet, when the cabinet started working and it was announced, the charge of the affairs of U.S. Embassy was, he went to the Pakistan Foreign Ministry on what they call in the diplomatic terms as summoned, and a protest was made that the government did not like a drone attack which had taken place immediately after the inauguration of the government. That position continues, and I think on that the Pakistan Muslim League is not alone. You've had statements from Imran Khan. You've had statements from other political parties which would like this issue to be resolved, and I gather that very recently the Pakistan ambassador in New York has been asked to raise this in the Security Council. So this is one irritant which need to be overcome. If there are pockets of Al-Qaeda or pockets of extremists in Northwest Frontier Province or in the what you call the federally administered tribal areas, there will have to be a joint understanding between the two governments as to what action to be taken and perhaps some understanding as to who takes that action. There will also need to be a reassessment of to what extent the United States can trust the Pakistani intelligence and to what extent Pakistani intelligence can trust the U.S. Agencies, because I think it's the lack of trust which continues to show the discord between the Pakistan government on the drain on the drone issue. And I think one reason advanced by the U.S. side is that if you give you the intelligence in advance and you decide to take the drone or whatever action, then obviously the information will be passed on to the targeted people and they will disappear from that location and the whole operation will go futile. So there is a need for the two sides to sit together and draw a joint action plan. I must also point out that very recently Pakistan has been pursuing the negotiations option. This is not something that the United States altogether rejects. They, as you know, that they tried to open an office in Qatar for those Taliban leaders who were willing to negotiate, although the initiative did not go too far. Only 2-3 days ago, on the request of President Karzai, the government of Pakistan have released two Al-Qaeda leaders who might be instrumental when they return to Afghanistan, that who might be instrumental in restarting the negotiations. So both options are being tried. One is the military option, and on that option, there needs to be an understanding between the Pakistan government and the U.S. administration as to how that operation should be successfully concluded without eroding the relationship between the two countries or between the establishments of the two countries. And secondly, whether the option of negotiations, which is now being experimented, is something that will be supported by both sides, because if you have international guarantors for negotiations, which is a complicated and sometimes it's a process which takes long, if that takes roots, then it will be perhaps the best option, because after 2014, the U.S. forces will not be there, and it is far better and economical to have the Afghans develop a process where they bring in national reconciliation and they try to bring in groups which for one reason or the other have taken arms, and there is a general DRR, disarmament and surrendering of the arms, and the same people who are now sort of using guns start using pens and become useful citizens of that country.
Sheriff, I know I, for one, have really enjoyed this conversation and have gained some deep insight from you into Pakistan, the enigma that we see from the United States perspective. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about this complex yet such significant and significant subject in world politics and South Asia in general.
No, I'm delighted that you chose this topic. I don't know how much appetite there is for Pakistan and the United States, but there would be circles, groups who would want to know more about Pakistan. And I think the advantage of modern technology is such that you can get to hear many views. Some of the most sophisticated analysis and comments on Pakistan actually emanate from Pakistan. And, of course, you have think tanks in the United States which are taking some very serious discussion that is taking place around in the region. And it's very interesting to see how all this is contributing to a general understanding of the issues, because in order to resolve issues and resolve problems and conflicts, the first step is trying to understand the nature of the conflict and the underlying elements which are contributing to it. So if you can diagnose the problem, then it becomes easier to try and treat them for having me in your chat room today.
Our pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed. And thank you, Bill, and thank you, Yusuf, once again for your time and for choosing me for this afternoon.
Thank you.